Does Friendly have a taste? If it does, it's probably like Hello's peppermint-flavored anti-plaque and whitening toothpaste. Brush away plaque, show tartar who's boss, and remove surface stains to naturally whiten. Hello's thoughtful and flavor-forward products make brushing your teeth feel like a confetti-filled bathroom dance party. So say hello to Hello with the always cruelty-free, never tested on animals toothpaste that's made to spread smiles. Visit HelloProducts.com and let Hello add some everyday yay into your life.
Hello, everyone. Welcome to The Next Level. I'm JVL here with my best friends, Sarah Longwell and Tim Miller of The Bulwark. Before we get started, hit the thumbs up button, hit the subscribe, give us 5 stars, and when you're done with all that, head over to thebulwark.com and sign up for all of the free stuff we give away. We give away a fabulous morning newsletter by Charlie Sykes every single day for free. I don't even know why we do it. How do we make money? On volume. We make it up on volume.
There's a lot of volume.
We got Charlie's great show, Moda, but the truth is we've got you'll be emailing us saying, please, Mr. Bulwark, stop sending us all this free stuff. We're sick and tired of all the winning.
That's true.
Okay. Also, housekeeping note, come and hang with us on YouTube tonight at 8 p.m., where we're going to talk about the wonderful, beautiful, Big D energy, Ron DeSantis announcement as he sits down in a Twitter space with Elon Musk. Can you feel the excitement?
I have a lot to say.
I do think it's kind of funny that Kamala Harris was able to do a big, gigantic, everybody look at me, thousands of people there, launch event. And Ron DeSantis is like, I'll be over on the slightly better version of Rumble.
Clubhouse. I'm in a clubhouse with an anti-Semitic memer. Audio only.
Sarah, let me go to you first. Again, I feel like we have to say this, make a disclosure on every single one of these things that we do. All of us would prefer that any other human being on the planet than Donald Trump be the Republican nominee. We would probably prefer, of the declared candidates, speaking only for myself, in descending order, Asa Hutchinson, followed by Tim Scott, followed by Nikki Haley. Point is, we'll even take Ron DeSantis, who is, in many ways, perhaps almost as dangerous as Trump, but in a couple key ways, probably not quite as dangerous as Trump. And so we'll take any of this. We're not rooting against any of these people. We are simply trying to give you real analysis. Because one of the problems we have right now, especially in anti-Trump world, is they want Ron DeSantis so bad that they won't actually tell you what they really think. And that's not how we work here at The Bulwark.
Good for us.
So, Sarah, with all that disclaimer out of the way, so you don't have to make it yourself.
Oof, that was quite the windup.
Tell us.
It was. I mean, I'm just enjoying watching Tim so desperate for a take. I'm incentivized to talk so slowly
right
now. I know.
That's why I went to you first.
Just to see if he'll explode with takes and get takes all over the screen. Here, I'm only going to say one thing, Tim. One big observation. It's adjacent to the Musk Twitter announcement. The Musk Twitter announcement coupled with, did you guys watch his launch video?
Mm-hmm.
The launch video is like him getting ready to take the stage to a fake crowd. And it is voiced. I was listening to it being like, is this voice British? Then I was like, is this a famous like Churchill speech? Like I'm finding myself Googling the language and I'm like, no, wait, this is like him. Like this is meant to be like the opening thing, but it's not DeSantis's voice and there's no
because
real crowd.
His voice is horrible.
So here's what I know. The hack in me knows this as sure as I know anything. They tested an ad with Ron DeSantis voicing his own video, and it tested badly. And they had to go get a voiceover, and they were nervous about the crowds. And, like, I had this whole thing about Ron DeSantis being too online, which is what the Musk thing is. I guess I had sort of been like, no, this guy's a real governor. He won by 20 points. Like, this is not. But, like, the idea that he would announce on Twitter with Elon Musk, I don't know if he realizes how old most Republican voters are. Like, the gerontocracy of our voters preclude any idea that they would be sitting on Twitter and waiting for Ron DeSantis's tech announcement. But I'll let Tim go now, but that's my top line.
Well, I'm sorry. I have a question for you first, Sarah. Do you think this counts as an in-kind contribution?
I'm starting to forget all my takes. Some of them are leaking out the back. Sorry, continue.
Does this count as an in-kind contribution? Or because Twitter is most definitely not a media platform, they say all the time, right? We're not like, you can't hold us to the same legal standards that you hold news sources like the New York Times or CBS News. We're different from that. And so if they're different from that, is this a contribution then?
I love that question. I don't think so, because I don't know the monetary value of it, which I'm not sure you could price, but...
It's not $44 billion, that's for sure.
It's not. So I don't know that it's an in-kind contribution. It's all very weird, though. The idea that Elon Musk and Ron DeSantis...
Having already endorsed him, is now hosting him to make his announcement on his platform... It's weird.
Musk hasn't endorsed him for 24, though.
He did. He pre-endorsed him like eight months ago.
It was kind of like a stray tweet. I don't know if it was an official endorsement.
Yeah.
Musk tweets a lot.
He said, I am supporting Ron DeSantis for president.
Here's the thing. Like, my favorite thing about Elon Musk is how he doesn't understand what free speech means. And it does seem perfect that Elon Musk is going to have Ron DeSantis on. They will probably confab about their mutual love of free speech. And both of them are massive restrictors of free speech that they don't like. Okay, I'm done with my takes, Tim. You go.
I thought that the problem with the last Twitter regime was that they were biased against a particular ideology. So is this an endorsement? I guess so.
No, I don't think so.
One of his blue check fanboys tweeted asking if he'd support DeSantis in 24, and he replied yes.
But we don't know if that context was in the primary or in the general.
An economy of words there from Elon Musk, which is unusual. So I want to get back to Elon Musk, and I have big takes about David Sacks, Meatball Sacks, as I like to call it, Meatball Jr., who is also in this audio-only Twitter space. I think that that's worth just everybody batting around a little bit. But I just on the strategy side of why Ron DeSantis is doing it like this. I think both of you hit on interesting points. Sarah, on the gerontocracy side of things, I had a reporter call me the other day or yesterday and ask, you know, if this might be a smart idea, right? Because Donald Trump dominated the cable news, the TV battle space with his call-ins and, you know, and he dominated the conversation that way. And maybe DeSantis can do that for a modern, you know, using more modern tools than cable. Now we're 8 years on, you know, fewer people have cable, et cetera, et cetera. And it wouldn't be a bad point if Ron DeSantis was a Democrat, but he's a Republican. And my point is the median Republican primary voter is 65 plus, didn't go to college, and is not engaging in audio only, which I've mentioned three times now, Twitter spaces. It's very strange. It is not reaching the target audience. It is the audience that it's reaching is the people that he doesn't need, right? Which are the people that already be with him. The college educated, highly online, uber, you know, engaged in politics, Ben Shapiro listening, you know, Chris Rufo fans, you know, who you know, follow this stuff very closely. Twitter would be a native platform for them. But those are already going to be DeSantis's people. The people that he needs to get either never got on Twitter in the first place, barely understood how to use it, just had Donald Trump alerts coming to their phone, you know, have already moved over to Truth. I mean, obviously we're this is generalizing. There may be a handful of people, but it's not the core base that you would want to reach to. So then I guess what's the strategy? We're going to get a lot of buzz for this. And other people will talk about it. And there's maybe something to be said for that, right? I can see myself in a meeting. And I was trying to imagine myself in the Ron DeSantis high command room, which gave me the shivers a little bit. Once I started thinking about it, I started to wash myself. But I was like, I could see myself being initially saying, no, this is a bad idea. And then hearing some other jabroni try to convince me it's a good idea because of the impressions. And we're going to get a lot of attention on this. And
we'll be able to say that we got 3 million simultaneous listeners. And Donald Trump only had 1,000 people at Mar-a-Lago when he announced.
Right. And there's something to that, right? He would be able to get more attention for this than like if he did a midday Tallahassee announcement where he, you know, talked about the Florida miracle and the war on woke and just gave his normal stump speech. Like this will be you'll get more interest on this than that. That's true. But like, is it going to be good interest? That's what you have to find out tonight on our live stream. Tonight being Wednesday, by the way, for people listening on Thursday, 8 Eastern, tune in for our live stream. We'll see what he says. But my sense is that he's going to be beta, right? Do we need to listen to this? It's like, do you really want to put Ron DeSantis in a stream with edgelord Elon Musk? Where, you know, Elon Musk is the, is, no matter how good Ron DeSantis' performance is, no matter how effusive Elon is in praise, Elon's kind of the alpha, you know, where Elon will assuredly say something you don't like. And there's all the baggage. He did the anti-Semitic tweets recently. He's done some very weird sexist tweets recently. He did some Russia-friendly tweets recently. So, like, you're now carrying all that baggage with you. That seems to me really stupid. Lastly, just before we get into the Elon side of this, the crowd side of this, which you mentioned, JVL, Amanda in our Slack made this point. I think it's really smart. I think that probably what this comes down to for them is they're like, we can't draw that. I mean, we can draw a kind of big crowd. I mean, even Jeb, so Jeb, we drew a very respectable crowd for the announcement. It was our biggest crowd. I'm going from memory. I think it was probably like 4,000 people, maybe five. We filled like a small gym. It was like a, you know, like a D3 college gym in Kendall, Miami, right? And so, you know, it wasn't like the Hurricanes gym. It was another basketball team, college, small college basketball team's gym. We filled it. It felt full. It was nice. DeSantis could have done something like that, right? But that's still, then you start to get into the dick size comparisons, right? With Trump and like, well, I could fill a football stadium and like, you seem really weak. And this allows him to avoid that. So I think that the attention, you know, the argument that he could get more attention for this and the crowd size element were the real drivers. But it just, it feels beta.
I want you to keep talking because I feel bad for making you wait so long, but I also want to hear some Musk thoughts from you.
Well, the Musk thing, so David Sacks is the other guy that is in the, that is, I guess, moderating this space, and he's a bundler out of Silicon Valley. Now, I've been monitoring this asshole for a while, and I think that it's important to understand David Sacks to really get what's happening here.
Isn't he the one who was told that he wasn't needed at the Twitter meeting, famously?
I believe so. I believe he was the one that Elon was like, you know, you have no expertise here.
This is a technical meeting. You wouldn't understand what's going on here.
Correct.
Basically, he is Chris Christie to Elon's
exactly.
Trump.
Exactly. So, and he's Chris Christie also to Peter Thiel's Trump. So David Sacks is the Chris Christie to two alphas. So him and Thiel were friends in college. They co-wrote Thiel's book together, which has a lot of like weird, things that are kind of like quasi-racist, like multiculturalism is bad and we shouldn't be encouraging diversity and like things like this. So he wrote this book with Thiel. He's one of the big, these guys who were really one of the core reasons I had to leave the Bay Area, which are the biggest assholes in the world. So the people who are like the sixth employee at early, you know, startup companies, you know, were like, they didn't do anything special. Like, he was the COO. Like, he was like the head HR man for PayPal. And it was like Elon and Peter Thiel's like baby. Like, it was there. They were the smart ones who deserved the money on the back end. But since he was the sixth employee, he had a bunch of shares and he becomes like a billionaire. Right. So capitalism, three cheers. So Dave, yay, capitalism. He also founded something called Yammer, which I guess he sold, which I've never really heard of. Maybe it was a good product. I don't know. So anyway, so he was Peter Thiel's kind of Robin to Thiel's Batman, and then now has kind of glommed on to Musk, and he's got this podcast called the All In Podcast, which is like for these contrarian right wing Silicon Valley guys. So there's a token lib and at Jason on Twitter, who's awful, and Chamath, who some of you people might know. So I've been monitoring this thing for a while because it's really influential in a certain space in tech. And these guys initially position themselves, just like Elon did, as like, we're center right. The woke stuff is going a little too far in Silicon Valley. Like, we're going to be a ballast against that. And one of my friends, actually my brother and a friend, suggested I listen. Because like, you might like this. These guys are a little more conservative than you, but they're moderate. They're in the middle. And, you know, maybe it's an interesting. Okay, so I started listening to them. It's full red pill. Like, it's full reactionary. These guys are moderate in the opposite way that we are, right? It's like, we shouldn't be in the war in Ukraine, right? Like, totally, you know, reactionary on that stuff. Completely reactionary on immigration, right? But I'm against Paul Ryanomics. You know, it's like, it's the inverse. I've gone culturally right, you know, to push back against the cultural left, but on the economic stuff, like, okay, maybe. All right. So that's where like these guys have gone. And I think that is the most telling thing about this that a lot of people aren't going to appreciate about the DeSantis announcement. They're going to focus on the Elon piece. They're going to focus on, it's kind of weird that it's a Twitter space. But having the, his now inner, clearly his inner circle are the people that he wants to launch his campaign with, being these contrarian, anti-neocon, anti-woke, you know, culture war, you know, types. Like me, that is the core of what, of the kind of campaign that DeSantis is going to run. And I think that there's going to be a lot of, you know, people in our National Review friend, our Wall Street Journal friends that want to like deny this and kind of act like, oh, he's just, he's playing footsie with that. But this is the core of what this campaign is going to be about. I'm deeply skeptical that the Republican base like cares about, you know, all the things that these rich, contrarian, white assholes care about, you know, ESG and DEI and digital currency. I, all that makes sense. When I wrote last month about how it's kind of weird that DeSantis' stump speech includes ESG and digital currency stuff. When I wrote that about the, to your point, Sarah, about the being very online, I was like, what is behind this? And what I initially thought it was his staff are like super online weirdos who are pushing it. But increasingly, I think, no, like this is his circle now. He's getting texts from these Silicon Valley contrarians who really care about the fact that in their social circles, they think the liberals have gone too woke and crazy. And now we need to push back on this. And that is influencing DeSantis to go down this rabbit hole, which includes the Disney fight. That all of which feels just, you know, not hostile to what, and I'm not sure what you think about this, Sarah, not hostile to what the focus group folks care about, but like a little bit like two steps away from their core interests, right? Like they also agree that woke is bad, and they, once you explain what DEI is to them, they don't like it, but like it feels a little alien. Like, I don't think they want a Silicon Valley contrarian billionaire bros podcast's concerns are not the same as the average concerns of a Greenville, you know, MAGA Republican.
So what you're saying is that we are like 3 weeks away from having Mencius Moldbug and Bronze Age Pervert as like informal advisors to the DeSantis campaign.
Yeah.
Basically. Right. Yeah. And so this brings me to you, Sarah. What are the people saying?
So first, I just want to, before I tell you this, because I do have some, I got some breaking news just for you guys. Actually, it's not breaking news, but I do have some good focus group stuff. The thing about Elon and DeSantis and why I think it's weird, I didn't quite realize, I hadn't clocked the idea that the Twitter space is just audio
only.
Like they're not even going to show their faces. Okay, so
strange.
Elon and Peter Thiel and DeSantis all have something in common, which is like they're not great at eye contact or being with other humans or talking to them in ways that are normal. I've done so many focus groups and the way that people identify with Trump and you're like, but I'm sorry, how do you identify with this guy with a gold toilet? And it's because Donald Trump talks in ways they can understand, makes politics accessible to them. He's repetitive in the way that he talks, like hammers and points and people can get it. They can like follow him. And like he feels normal and real to them in a way that I think it took all of us a long time to like understand how that is because we see like a big distance. But sort of makes sense as you've gone along. Like he was a celebrity, so they just feel like they know him. He was in their living rooms for a long time. DeSantis and like all of these guys who are in this weird Silicon Valley bubble, like their human instincts are terrible. This is his signature problem right now is people are like, you like short circuit as a human being. Like you don't know how to talk to people. You seem fake and your laugh is off and you seem weird. So for him to lean into this weird crowd to me is for him doubling down on the thing that is not working for him right now.
It's probably what makes these Silicon Valley guys good. Like what made them brilliant
good,
and what made
right.
them billions, right? Is that they're a little strange. Like, you know, conventional thinkers don't come up with like PayPal ideas. So that probably maybe not David Sachs, but Peter Thiel and Elon, it probably was like their personality disorder. I contributed to them thinking they could do this thing, you know, that other people who aren't like egomaniacal wouldn't have thought about, right? So there's something to be said for that, but that doesn't translate right. as well to politics.
It doesn't, although you could see a world in which DeSantis is actually something of a competent executive.
Sure.
His story from Florida is like warped, I actually think, by now his national profile. But like the reason, like, if a Jeb Bush would tell you they like Ron DeSantis is in part he took the environmental stuff really seriously in the state. He's been quite good. And, like, before his profile got so national and, like, this legislative session, like, his last legislative session was quite good. And, like, the way that he handled COVID, like, we don't like the yelling at reporters, but he did just make a decision. I'm going to open things up and I'm going to leave them open. And so, and people liked that. Like, that is why
the vaccine stuff was also really bad.
The vaccine stuff was bad, although he was good on it at first, right? It was like he moved on that, right? Because he's a different version now. It's like as his profile got more nationalized, he felt the need to be an anti-vaxxer. But in the beginning,
because remember, it was the cruise ships. It was pretty early he was bad on vax.
I don't. Are you
the
sure?
Cruise ships were trying to require vaccines, and he was like, "No, you can't require vaccines to get on cruise ships." That was like really early before we even really knew, you know, what we were trying to figure out with the details. So I think he was bad on vax pretty early. I agree with all of your other points.
My point is that the idea that he is like a competent executive, but that doesn't necessarily translate to a national profile where like people aren't digging in or feeling the impact of what you do every day, your decisions. And so they kind of need to like you. So I think it's weird that he has decided to go with this. Yeah. That where they like are incapable of having good human instincts. So I went and had someone on my team pull all of the focus groups where we did just straight two-time Trump voters. Now, we do people across the political spectrum. We do screens where we ask people if they have high favorability of Trump or low favorability of Trump. These, but we've done a whole bunch since the last election, 22, since November, that are just straight two-time Trump voters. And from 11/29, so November 29th in 2022, to immediately before the Trump indictments, in the groups when we asked head-to-head, who do you want, Trump or DeSantis, 44 people wanted DeSantis and 26 people wanted Trump.
That was November 29th till when?
Right before the Trump indictment.
Okay.
Right before he gets indicted. Okay? So from the Trump indictment to now, 32 people versus 9 went for Trump. So 32 people went Trump, 9 went DeSantis. And I don't usually, it's not good usually to take your qual and like make it quant because it's not the same thing as a poll. But like we've done enough of these.
Not enough.
Right? Like it's not, this is like 70 people in the first sample, right? Where you've got 44 people for DeSantis and 26 for Trump. After the indictment, you've got 32 for Trump, 9 for DeSantis. The exact same kinds of groups. We're not, they're just the same kinds of just normal two-time Trump voters. That reversal is stunning. And there's going to be a lot of conversation today and in the next couple of days about why Ron DeSantis's fortunes appear to have reversed. And a lot of people are going to focus on Trump and the indictment, like accelerating Trump's profile. And that's part of it. But I actually think it has a lot more to do with the fact that people started to see DeSantis. So right around Trump's indictment, two things happened. One, his Ukraine deal where he had to walk it back because the establishment got mad at him. And then his comment around Stormy Daniels when MAGA got mad at him and he had to reverse that and say, no, I'm going to do an extradition for you. I won't extradite him from Florida. And Trump was like, screw you. And Trump started attacking him, right? Those things all happened. And also Jeb Bush endorsed him. But like all of those things started to happen. And like you just see him drop like a stone. And I was listening to the focus group. We just did one a couple days ago. And they're mad about the indictment of Trump. They're on his side about that. They just like the Disney thing is like, there's some people are like, yeah, Disney sucks. But like most people are kind of like, what? I don't like why? And it's just, it's not the thing. Like that is not the thing that is going to get everybody like on Ron DeSantis's side. And these people are not on Twitter. This is the thing about the focus groups. Again, always they keep me grounded and like, some people are on Twitter. Some people say I don't like the tweets. Some people say I don't like the tweets and they've never actually seen the tweets. They just know that the tweets are bad or they see them on TV or in some other medium. But like these people are not on Twitter, but they are people who vote in primaries and in general elections.
One sentence on the Disney thing, because it relates to the Sachs point. And again, like this idea about this concern about woke capital, like there is a legitimate niche group of college educated high-income Republicans who care about this deeply, right? Who are like, the boards are woke. They're making us invest in green companies, blah, blah, blah. And the David Sachs, Elon Musk guys are at the center of this. And my understanding from our friend Ron Filipkowski and Peter Sorsch, who's an awesome reporter, is that in Florida, there's also some personal Disney stuff happening. But like that stuff is tied. That like DeSantis thought that this Disney thing was going to be a winner because that the MAGA base is upset about woke capital. And it's like, eh, it's a specific slice of it that really cares about this. And I'm sure if you asked in the focus groups, are you mad that companies are woke? People would be like, yeah, sure, I'm mad that companies are woke. It's not like he's going against them. But is their core concern boardroom fights, you know, and investment portfolios? You know what I mean? Like, maybe if he had leaned into, like, the Target display, right? Like, there's this, like, story just yesterday that, like, in a lot of red areas, Target has had to take down their Pride display, not really because they're anti-Pride, not because they had changed their mind, but because, like, they're worried about the safety of their employees. Like, things have gotten hot. Like, that's in the face of these voters.
They're just worried that their customers might violently assault their employees. Perfectly normal for business, right?
Nothing to worry about here.
Just like Republican politicians worried about their voters hurting them.
And I'm sure the same people that are mad about BLM are really mad about this. But the point is, that is, like, at least in their face, you know, that, like, maybe the MAGA voters are like, yeah, it does annoy me that there's, like, trans stuff when I walk into the store, right? Okay, but that's different than saying, oh, I'm mad about these corporate, you know, like, fights that they engage in. And so the combination of, like, him getting kind of baited into this by the David Sacks world and then getting slapped around by Disney isn't maybe the number one thing that has caused his numbers to go down, but it's all related. It's made him seem weak. It's a little weird. It's a little out of touch. Like, it's a piece of all the other elements.
There is a simple explanation for all of this, which is that DeSantis has decided that he's going to position himself as a demagogue. And that is, I mean, his campaign is, I am a demagogue who is on your side against the people who you hate. Trump is also a demagogue, but Trump is a lot better at it than DeSantis is.
DeSantis is like a simulacrum of a demagogue. Like, he's like an imitation, like a pale shadow of a demagogue. Like, I think this is how a demagogue acts with this accordion hands.
Yeah. I mean, look, Trump sees the Disney thing for what it is, which is, right, he's going to demagogue then DeSantis saying, oh, look, you're costing all these jobs. And I think that that is more likely to resonate with voters than, like, DeSantis's, I'm mad at them because they have gay characters in crappy movies. The Silicon Valley Bank, right? The failure. When DeSantis decides he's going to demagogue that by talking about, you know, it's their woke ESG stuff, where Trump then looks at it and is like, yeah, we're going to have a run on the banks and the entire system's going to collapse and we're all going to be poor. It's just a much more effective thing, I think.
Trump being stupid helps him here. DeSantis isn't stupid. He went to Harvard and Yale, and he's on a baseball scholarship, so, you know, maybe not the top of his class, but he's not an idiot. DeSantis is smart. People that talk to him think he's smart, right? Like, Trump's more, like, New York Post kind of, like, reading level, you know, even though he kind of has his, like, weird Trump affect, like the words that he uses are more, you know, in line with what Republican voters are. I will say this, but we've been dogging all the DeSantis stuff, and I stand by all of it. The thing that worries me about all this is there is this desire, particularly among the pundit class and everybody, to be like, oh, because he seems so weak, that's over. Like, oh, it was over before it started. Like, it might be over before it started. But it is important to go back to the Biden lesson. JVL was the only person that stuck with Joe Biden besides his campaign all the way through, you know, him finishing sixth place in New Hampshire. Like, sometimes things fall in your lap. And, like, DeSantis, like, remains, like, well-positioned for this to fall in his lap, like, against all, you know, strategic imperatives, right? Like, that just happens in politics sometimes. Politics is not chess. Like, you know, it's not always the person that is the best player that wins. And so I think it's worth saying that, like, his positioning is, like, a little off, two steps off. And it's worth analyzing that. But two steps off might be enough, because everybody else in the race's position is, like, eight steps off, right? Like, they're not even on the field, right? And you know, we might get to January and this, the same reason why DeSantis was doing well last December might be relevant this December, when people are just like, I just want to win. And that is, I think, where it rings back to. That is why the analysis of his style and all that is so important, because he's got to seem like he can win, and he kind of doesn't now.
So I did a deep dive on this for the Triad, which is my newsletter, which is going to come out on Wednesday. You should go to thebulwark.com and sign up to get it. It's quite good. Sarah reads it 40% of the time. Yeah, very good.
And sometimes to get the third one, you got to be a Bulwark Plus subscriber. And it's the best $8 I spend, except for, I mean, I guess there are a couple other things.
Well, maybe not the best $8, but it's a very good $8. Here's the thing. So I went back and actually pulled the data for everything going back to 2000. Trump's position is so much stronger than any other front runner during that time. Hillary Clinton, remember how Hillary Clinton in 2008? Even Hillary Obama. At this point in the race, Hillary's lead was between 14 and 20 points. The biggest her lead ever got was in September, and it was in one or two polls where she popped a 30. One or two polls. The average of Trump's lead right now is 36. And the other thing that happened is that her lead was against Obama, who slowly chipped away, and then broke through. Obama never fell back, right? I mean, the fallback is important because what it means is that voters have taken a hard look at the candidate, right? A lot of times what you're looking at
is... already won Iowa. He fell back briefly after he'd
Right, briefly. But even then, in the national polls, like, they're right there. You know, he didn't lose 40% of his support, which is what DeSantis has done over the last 3 months here. And, you know, that a lot of politics is struggling to get a first look from voters, right? Like, Tim Scott, Nikki Haley are dying just to be looked at. And DeSantis achieved that. And the problem is, and that's good for him, the problem is that once voters saw it, a fair number of them were like, yeah, no thanks, right? And so now he's got to earn a second look. And you look at it and you say, well, why would a second look work for him? And historically, when this is worked out for people, like John McCain got his second look in 2008. Why? Because he based his entire campaign around the idea that George W. Bush should follow David Petraeus' plan for a surge in Iraq. Nobody else was on this. McCain was the one who was banging this drum, both on the campaign trail and in Washington, where he was sort of betting his candidacy on the wisdom of this. What is that version for DeSantis, right?
Biden did this. Biden got a second look, but what was it? It wasn't so much an issue like McCain. It was a specific slice of the electorate. It was black voters, right? Like, black voters basically said, does DeSantis have that? And it's like, I guess college-educated whites, but they don't play as big of a role in the Republican primary as black voters do in the Democratic primary.
I really agree with this. So it's not that Ron DeSantis, I think, explodes in popularity. I don't think that's the scenario. I think that you hit Iowa, which is a good state for Ron DeSantis, right? And none of this matters till the voting starts. And you have a caucus, also good for DeSantis. And DeSantis pulls out, Trump's polling nationally, let's say 20 points ahead going into the election. But DeSantis pulls out a win. Okay, well, now this is interesting. And then you go into New Hampshire and Trump keeps it super close. They're like kind of neck and neck. But DeSantis is hanging in there. And then
you go to the South.
Well, yeah, the problem is then you hit South Carolina. But again, I don't know what do Nikki and... Do they cut a deal, Nikki and Scott, for VP there? Like, how does that break? I will say going into Nevada, I think that's Trump's. That's what catapulted Trump into Super Tuesday the last time, is coming out of Nevada. Like, it was back and forth in the early states, and then Nevada, he just crushed and bounced. Here's the thing, though. So I think that could happen again pretty easily. I actually see many more paths for Trump than I do DeSantis. But I also do just see, with all the indictments, Trump being Trump, like, who knows what might just break right around then, where people sort of say, I'm going for the younger, more electable guy.
Right. But you need exogenous events is the point, right? As Tim says, you're the understudy and you just got to wait and see if it falls apart. To be honest, what this race really feels like to me, I'll just spoil the newsletter since you won't read it anyway, Sarah. It feels much more like the Gore versus Bill Bradley, right? And Bill Bradley made it a race, sort of, right? Yep. Bill Bradley, you know, was down by 35 points and, you know, it was like 70-30 or something. And then he came back to push Gore in Iowa and put a scare into him and Al Gore. Right? So Ron DeSantis prevents this from being a coronation. Because absent DeSantis, this is a coronation, right? I mean, maybe the state chairs just say, we're going to do this by acclamation. We don't even need to vote. And so there will be some horse racing. And maybe DeSantis, you know, maybe Trump falls apart and DeSantis can regather momentum, or maybe DeSantis himself implodes. Who knows? But the point is, we've got like three different pathways here, each of which is probably about as likely as the other.
It's interesting you said the Hillary thing, because I haven't come back and looked. And I compared the bull case for DeSantis is that he's Obama.
for V. Hillary, right? That she's strong, but like has these underlying weaknesses. And but I didn't realize that the lead never got that large.
No.
I thought it was closer.
Also, Obama was a generational political talent, and DeSantis.
Well, yeah, I was just gonna say
not right. This is another problem with that analogy.
This is the problem that none of these candidates are particularly like. I was watching Tim Scott have his opening conversation. And he's sort of figured out how to handle the Trump question, right? Which is, by the way, one of Trump's built-in structural advantages is the way that everybody's going to ask each of the candidates about Trump all the time. But when he got asked it, he was like, I'm here. I'm not here to talk about another candidate. I'm here to make my optimistic pitch. Like, okay, that's how he went around Trump. Fine. But his whole talk is boring as all get out. And it's canned. And it looks like he's been rehearsing this in the mirror for a long time, and it just sucks. Like, it's not good. And like, I like Tim Scott, take him any day, twice on Sunday, over most of the field.
So we did Bradley Whitford this week for the next Sunday show. We just taped it. And like, his thing was about how the most unrealistic thing about the West Wing was that we had to make the Republicans too nice, you know, because we don't want to turn off Republican viewers. And like, we couldn't have a Trump or Palin-esque Republican. But Tim Scott would have been a great TV Republican, right? Like, he's generic in that sense. The thing that bugs me, though, that you said that, because we haven't spent a ton of time. We've spent about as much time on Tim Scott as his campaign for vice president deserves, I guess. But like, I hate that everyone lets him off the hook with that answer, actually. It's like, he's losing to Donald Trump by 55 points. 54, excuse me, in the RCP average. He's 1.8. Trump is 56.3, okay? 56.3 to 1.8. You cannot go into a race where you're at 1.8 and someone else at 56.3 and people ask you about that 56.3 person and you're like, I chastise you, media, for caring about you just won a Republican food fight and you don't want to care about the majors. It's like, no, you're entering a campaign where there's already a person that has 56% support. You have won. What is your argument for why people should move off him onto you? Like, there's no other case in the world where, you know, somebody would enter into a competition and be just getting absolutely slaughtered and get away with the, well, I'm just going to talk about optimism and cheeriness. And everybody looks at you, you're an insane person. Like, that's insane. Like, we're in a competition here. That sounds nice. And I'm sure that you're 1.8% of the Republican primary voters like that. And I have respect for those people. But like, it's absurd. It's absurd.
It also sounds like politics as usual. It sounds like the old politics.
Yeah.
And that's not what Republican voters want. Trump's phony authenticity is not phony, if that makes sense, right? I mean, like, he just says the things that come to his mind, whether they're true or not. And he is unscripted and that stuff is gold. It's gold. You see this all the time with Sarah, don't you, talking to the voter? Like, they want someone who is authentically themselves, right?
Yeah, and they can sniff out the phonies. And also, it's not just that authentically themselves. Like, Trump changed the standard of behavior in all kinds of ways. Obviously, like, now sexual assault is okay, and being horrible and being racist, all those things are
unfortunately,
okay.
Unfortunately
or fortunately. But he also changed the game in terms of, like, how loose you need to be. Like, are you going to give me a 70-minute stump speech? Because I'm going to tap out. I don't care. You know, I want to see the town hall where you're running over the pretty young media person who's a stand-in for all the fake, phony corporate media that I hate. And, like, you know, they want the show. And so the answer that Tim Scott gave to me isn't, like, necessarily, it's not the answer. It's like in his hands, that answer is sort of a pathetic, mealy mouth political answer. Now, this is what I keep sort of saying is, like, there is a lane to consolidate people who want to move on from Trump. That's a real, not just lane, that's a real, like, chunk of the party. But, like, somebody has to come seize it and seize it by being like, why would we talk about Trump? Stop asking me about Trump. Trump is yesterday's news. And let me tell you what. This guy changed the game for our party in great ways, but he's not able to deliver. And he lost the last election. I mean, like, I know what we can all, like, then pick apart.
Chris Sununu, right? Chris Sununu keeps making noises that he'll be that guy.
Yeah. And I would love to see it. Like, I don't know if you guys saw this just while we were on, and I'm sorry that I did look at my phone.
Apology not accepted.
Nate Silver. Yeah, sorry. Okay. But Nate Silver tweeted something like, I'm surprised by how mean these Never Trumpers are being to every candidate other than Trump, which, of course, is being quote tweeted by a bunch of people who are like, well, this is just their grift.
Nate is getting red pilled so hard.
Yeah, no, he is. He's part of this whole, like, socially incapable, too online kind of person. What if the reason that we don't like these candidates, so like, I do like Tim Scott on paper in concept. Part of my, I am so frustrated that none of them are good enough to run a campaign to defeat Trump. Like, I would root for Ron DeSantis if Ron DeSantis was running a campaign that was anywhere close to something that could actually defeat Trump. And yesterday I tweeted something about, like, I don't understand Ron DeSantis' strategy over a clip of me talking about, like, there's this available chunk of the party. And for some reason, Ron DeSantis has decided instead of going and getting the people who want to move on and then building out a coalition with sort of the maybe Trumpers, right? There's the move on Trumpers. There's the maybe Trumpers. Like, that's your coalition you got to go get. He's like wrestling Trump for his death cult. And like that 30%. And I don't understand why. But of course, the anti-antis grabbed it and they were like, yeah, of course you wouldn't understand, you know, never Trumper. You just think that we should run like Liz Cheney.
I'm sorry, Sebastian put this tweet in and I'm off the deep end. My blood pressure just skyrocketed. Remains pretty amazing to me how disdainfully the never Trump crew treats Republican candidates other than Trump. Is it amazing? Is it amazing that people who are never Trump, it's right there in the name, never Trump, would have disdain for people that lick Trump's balls every time they're asked about him? Like, is that what's amazing about that? What's amazing about that? If there's a candidate that said Trump was bad, we would like them because we don't like Trump. It's right there in the name, never Trump. And like, they want us to be like, oh, I want to excuse Tim Scott, who said that it's not Trump's fault that January 6th happened, because he's nice and he's like one of these old kind of Republicans that you should like. And oh, you should excuse, you know, Chris Christie, who went and like fetched Donald Trump's sandwiches for him and like, oh, and did Trump apologia even after Trump gave him COVID. And it's like, why? Why? For 8 years, all these guys have done is be Trump little butt boys. And now it's like our obligation to try to shine them up? Fuck you.
Yeah, there's a category error here, though, which Nate is touching on, but which is very real in anti-Trump circles, which is this assumption and belief that people who do politics for a living should talk about what they want and not what they think or what they see.
Great point.
Right. And what, as I said at the very beginning, what I want is for Asa Hutchinson or Tim Scott or any of these fucking guys to win the nomination. My job as I see it, and I think your job as you see it, are to try to express the analysis of the world that we see around us, not to run interference and do propaganda in order to somehow play a triple bank shot. Because if we can just fool an extra, you know, 500,000 people, then that will help run to say, but that's not our job. Our job is to see the world around it as it actually is and explain it to you, the people. And I'm sorry, these people are all doing a very bad job of running for president as reflected in the polls. And the idea that you're supposed to just pretend that like everything's great because that's the mission or something. I'm sorry. That's not, look, I love Joe Biden. Love me some Joe Biden. I don't go around pretending everything is great with Joe Biden. When things are bad with Joe Biden, I'm like, oh, this is
but
really
kind
of a problem
over here.
But I
also don't disdain Joe Biden.
Is,
you know why? Because Joe Biden was the person that stopped Donald Trump from ending our democracy. That's why I don't disdain Joe Biden, because Joe Biden says what he thinks about Donald Trump. Do I wish that somebody that, you know, had more classically liberal values, had a political career, would say what they thought about Donald Trump too? I do. I do wish that. But there aren't any. Except Mitt. I love you, Mitt.
This is going to make Sarah mad. I disdain Chris Sununu. And here's why I disdain Chris Sununu. Chris Sununu, when asked about the prospect of Donald Trump becoming president, his stock answer is Donald Trump won't be the Republican nominee. It isn't going to happen.
He's winning by 30 points.
And you know what? That's a fucking lie. That's a fucking lie. Chris Sununu doesn't know that. Nobody knows that. And also, you know, all signs point to probably, right? And I disdain the people who are interested in lying about this in order to play some triple bank shot or preserve their own viability or make the, just tell the truth. That's that. I just don't see any other, right? Just tell the truth.
That doesn't make me mad. In fact, I think I've talked about this before. Nothing has made me angrier than Chris Sununu answering the question of, will you support Donald Trump if he's the nominee, by saying yes, because that is disqualifying judgment. And this goes to answer sort of Nate Silver's question as well, which is, yeah, I'm not going to use the language that Tim did about licking things, but like, they helped Trump. They built the permission structure for Trump, and I disdain them. And Chris Sununu is even worse, because the more he's normal and good and has been a good governor and would probably make an excellent president. And for him to say, as a means for placating base voters that would never vote for him anyway, to run a presidential campaign, that it is acceptable for Donald Trump post-coup to be president again, builds that permission structure further and for more normal people. And like, that's the problem in our politics. And this is where I blame politicians, where you blame voters. You know, I think that a bunch of people who aren't paying nearly as close attention as Chris Sununu and don't have nearly as good political judgment have just been told by somebody that they respect and think is normal that Donald Trump is an acceptable choice to be president again. And I hate that. That doesn't mean I wouldn't take Chris Sununu over Trump every day and twice on Sunday, because I would. But that's the predicament that we're in. But Nate Silver asking that question as though it is not obvious why we do this, you know, means that they just don't understand anything.
It's all about posing, right? Yeah. You know, look, in your job as Republican voters against Trump, Sarah, I suspect you are going to spend a lot of money trying to help some other Republican beat Donald Trump, right? I think all three of us are probably going to, if I don't want to speak for you guys, vote in a Republican primary for somebody who is other than Donald Trump. Like, what more support? How do you support somebody? Those are the ways. You vote. You vote or you spend money on them. The rest of it, like, you know, in terms of like analyzing the world around us as it is, I'm sorry. We don't do propaganda, Nate. I'm very sorry about that. Does that hurt your feelings, you degenerate gambler?
Can I also just pimp another newsletter of yours this week from Tuesday? You did another good newsletter this week about Joe Biden. I know it's been a long show. We're running out of time here. Mm-hmm. It's been a really good show, but it was a good newsletter. And I have my complaint to Joe Biden, which we've discussed in the past, and I'm happy to again. But like, here he is. He's the president, and everyone in his party basically wants him to like print a coin to solve the debt limit problem. And he's like, I'm going to go work with Kevin McCarthy, who like really like doesn't deserve to shine his shoes, like based on Kevin McCarthy's behavior, but he's going to suck it up maybe a little later than he should have. And he's going to sit there with Kevin McCarthy and try to come up with a reasonable deal that maybe the Republican caucus will sink. We don't know yet. We'll see. But they're discussing a pretty reasonable deal about flat, making spending flat, or maybe dropping it 0.5% from last year's spending baseline, you know, something that certain interest groups on the left won't like. And I'm sure there'll be certain harms that come from, you know, that, but like, you know, you gotta be reasonable when it comes to budgeting. Obviously we're spending a little too much money. Obviously that contributed somewhat to inflation. And so he's coming to the table with a reasonable deal. And there's this like expectation that we as Never Trumpers, I don't want to speak for everybody, are supposed to like be mad about that, or like not be satisfied with this. Like, what, like Joe Biden has given people like who want centrist politics on the margins, like basically what they want. Like, there have been things that we've disagreed with. There have been things that we agree with. But every time we've come to one of these crises, every time we've come to one of these big issues, he's tried to do a bipartisan thing. There have been a couple areas, times where he's fallen short on that. The student loan thing comes to mind. But like most of the time, he's tried to do a bipartisan thing, tried to do a reasonable thing. And when your choice is that, or people that are running doing apologia full time for someone that tried to literally end our democracy, I don't know what's confusing about how we're assessing those choices. Anyway,
I can't wait for Nate's show on Twitter Spaces.
We'll be good.
It's going to be great. He's got some free time on his hands after getting fired from 538. All right, guys, good show, long show. There's all sorts of other stuff we were going to talk about, but we didn't get to it. Come and hang out with us tonight on YouTube at 8 p.m. in the East, where we are going to have listened to the Twitter space and we will talk about it and have fun with it. And everybody will be there. The whole gang is going to be like 15 people from the Bulwark. It'll be a mega cast. Hit the subscribe button. Hit the join button. Give us the thumbs up, because all of those things help. And actually, tell a friend. We're going to be flirting around with you guys in the comments on YouTube, too, as well, if you want. And then when you're done with all that, go to thebulwark.com and just sign up to get all the free stuff we give you in your inbox. It's good stuff.
Does anybody want to hear a quick story about the live show we did, which was awesome in New York? So I had said on one of the podcasts about when I was at the principal's first meeting, this woman, I was at the valet and I didn't have money to tip.
I remember
the, like, the valet bringing the car. Yeah. Right. Okay. So that woman was at the live show and I was like, hey, you're the woman who gave me $10. And I was immediately like, crap, I don't have $10 on me. Like, I just did a live show. And so I was like, oh man, I gotta pay this woman back. And I was like saying it to sort of the, you know, how like people kind of come back. There's all these people around us talking to us. And I was like, this is the woman who gave me the $10. And like five other people reached into their pockets to hand me $10. And I was like, this is just perpetuating the cycle of you kind people. Then I just owe you $10, other person I'll never find. But I just, our people, they're the best people. They're the best people.
All right. See you guys in a few hours.
Peace.
Bye.
Bye.
You're great at protecting your own personal information. You probably even use things like two-factor authentication, strong passwords, and a VPN. But as much as you try to be in control of how your information is protected, there are lots of places that also have it, and they might not be as careful as you are. That's why LifeLock monitors millions of data points every second for identity threats. If your identity is stolen, a LifeLock U.S.-based restoration specialist will help solve identity theft issues on your behalf, guaranteed, or your money back. Plus, all LifeLock plans are backed by the $1 Million Protection Package, meaning LifeLock will reimburse you up to the limits of your plan if you lose money due to identity theft. You might not be able to control how others handle your personal information, but you can help protect it with LifeLock. Save up to 40% your first year. Call 1-800-LIFELOCK and use promo code IHEART or go to LifeLock.com/iHeart for 40% off. Terms apply.
This message comes from Greenlight. Ready to start talking to your kids about financial literacy? Meet Greenlight, the debit card and money app that teaches kids and teens how to earn, save, spend wisely, and invest with your guardrails in place. With Greenlight, you can send money to kids quickly, set up chores, automate allowance, and keep an eye on what your kids are spending with real-time notifications. Join millions of parents and kids building healthy financial habits together on Greenlight. Get started risk-free at greenlight.com/iHeart.